Hello, hello, and welcome back or welcome to the Life Without Limits podcast. I'm your host, Yogi Roth, and we are in season two, and season two is smoking right now, and appreciate all the love and support, comments, sharing that everyone has provided online. This continues to grow and evolve as a really fun community. Now, today's conversation, I've been holding on to for a little while, I gotta be honest, just trying to find the right place where to drop it in, and I think it's right now. You know, it's Luke Tyberski. This man is ridiculous. He describes himself in a really cool phrase. He calls himself an endurance adventurer. And this guy, I came across him in a very unique way. Kind of saw his stuff happening on social media a little bit. A buddy of ours on this podcast, Michael Gervais, had interviewed him on his. But I didn't listen to it on purpose because I wanted to kind of have my own conversation with Luke. And what Luke did is phenomenal. Just imagine this for a second. You're in your kitchen and you pull out a globe and you look at it like we all do and you spin it. Maybe you close your eyes and you land your finger somewhere or you just start to imagine where you want to go and where you want to explore. That's exactly what Luke did. Except his exploration wasn't like Hawaii or let's even, you know, get aggressive and maybe we go to Southeast Asia and, you know, bike pack around Europe, whatever it may be. Now, his was aggressive. He decided that he was going to go from Morocco to Monaco in only 12 days and make up his own ultimate triathlon. And no one else was with him. He literally swam across the Strait of Gibraltar. So imagine swimming 400 laps in a 50-meter pool. Then he cycled along the coast in Spain over 1,300 kilometers in less than 5 days. And then he ran 14 combined marathons in only 7 days. I mean, that's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. And he captured it as the best part. And you know we love documentaries here in an acclaimed documentary film called The Ultimate Triathlon. He literally hit me up on social media and was like, I'm coming to LA. Can we connect? I said, sure. Showed up at my house. We sat upstairs and had this conversation. And listening back to this, it's really inspirational. One of my favorite lines he says is that I had a dream crowded with clarity to push my limits so I could see a glimpse of my potential. I mean, if that is not one of the most inspirational things you've heard, I don't know what is. I mean, he really goes deep in this conversation. Like many of us, he struggled with the transition from moving from being an athlete. He was a professional athlete to what do I do next? Some of us have dealt with that from high school to college and really just identity crisis that we've all dealt with from job to job, relationship to relationship. And he goes there. And I really love this man. I mean, he really dives in. This is one of my more fun conversations that I've had on this podcast. I think it'll cut you pretty deep. I think you'll enjoy every last drop of it and he will inspire you to seek your purpose. He'll talk about how he learned to love himself. And most importantly, he'll teach us, as he discusses, that if we want to achieve big things, like we all do, right? The purpose of this podcast is explore what does it mean to be human? And we've discussed this many times. That it's about going for it and playing big. Well, he leaves us with a really cool nugget at the end of the conversation, talking about if you want to achieve big things, you can't do it alone. And that and so many other gems really, I think, is at a perfect time for all of us is now it's mid-February. What are we doing with those New Year's resolutions? Where are we with our lives? And for Luke, I just want to thank you for coming into the studio, man. It was a great conversation. I think you'll all enjoy it as we bring on the amazing Luke Tyberski. Enjoy this endurance adventurer. All right, we talked about this one. Exciting. Sometimes things in life just kind of fall into your lap. And Luke, thankfully, you have come into the lap of the Life Without Limits podcast. And welcome to the Life Without Limits studio. It's pretty epic here in Venice Beach. Luke Tyberski, I don't know how to describe you, man. I mean, outside of just somebody who, when I watched your film, I felt like I knew. I felt like I'd known you forever. How would you describe yourself, man?
I describe myself as an endurance adventurer, which makes no sense to anyone. It's a title I made up. Because I do so many different things, I need an umbrella because there's no use, you know, if I meet someone on the street and they say, what do you do? Or, you know, what are you all about? It'd take me like 10 minutes to try and describe it. But for me, an endurance adventurer and what I do is just someone who lives life. every day. And I want to leave a trail of inspiration behind me. So if I wake up in the morning and I don't feel like I'm living life, or I don't feel like I'm sort of leaving like a path or a trail for someone to like grab onto and maybe try and live their life a little bit more, then I need to sort of check myself and go, well, is this really the path that I'm going down? This is what I want to do. And I guess that's me.
Wow. Okay. We're going to unpack that for sure.
But there's plenty.
There's plenty there to unpack. But I want to set the stage and make sure everybody knows why we're even sitting across one another. I came across your film. You thankfully reached out to me and sent me an email about your film. And this isn't just an everyday film or an everyday doc. This has some amazing moments in it. But you go on the ultimate triathlon. I mean, that's the title of the film. What about you what about you wanted to go on this type of adventure? I mean, this isn't like, I want to go run a marathon. I want to go hike a mountain. You're like, I want to go do something that is very uncommon to normal man.
Yeah, it's very. I don't recommend it, to be honest. But it starts at the end of 2011. And we're going to go back a little bit and we'll fast forward through that. But I was a broken down, injured soccer player. You know, I played professional soccer in the lower leagues, bounced around Europe, played over here in the States, went to college over here as well. And I just, when I was living in London, where I still live now, I was just struggling with all these injuries, kept breaking down and I couldn't get fixed. And I had some of the best medical team around in London who were taking care of me. I just couldn't mend to go to a club, have a trial and get signed, or I'd get like a month deal and break down. And then 3 years this went on for. Friends, family, girlfriend at the time was like, maybe your body's telling you something. But this was over a period of like 3 years when I was 25 to 28. So I was still very young. And I was like, I'm not ready. I'm not ready. You know, people talk about failing fast. And I agree with that. But I think you've got to take every instance for as its own. Because if you try and fail fast at everything, what if, like when we talk about grit, you know, like, so if you fail fast, do you have grit? You know, that's the thing with me. And I was just grinding away with my soccer career. And it got to a point where I was like, after 3 years, all these injuries, enough is enough. And I literally hobbled home, and iced my calf that I tore. And I'm still trying to figure this out now, 5 years later, why. But I went on my laptop and I remember this conversation I had with one of my mates from Australia who just started running marathons. And he told me about this race in the desert where you run 6 marathons in 7 days through the Sahara. You carry everything you need, food, medical supplies, everything in your backpack. And I Googled it and I found it. It was in 6 months. And I went, I'm going to do it. And I had never ran 10Ks before in my life, ever. My first ever race, signed up to it, 6 months. I called them up and it's expensive, you know. And without even thinking, I quite literally... I had, you know, a few thousand pounds in my savings account. I paid for it. I drained my savings account. So I went all in on a whim, just like that, the day I retired from soccer. And why, like, I know it was an escape from life, and because I didn't want to face up to the real world of I'm 28, now what am I going to do with the rest of my life? But why I thought of that, I have no idea. And then about a month or so after that, I was training and I thought, well, what am I going to do now? I thought, I want to be an adventurer. So this is where the answer comes to your question, getting to the ultimate triathlon. So I'm going to be an adventurer. I'm going to bounce around the world. I'm going to write magazine articles. I'm going to make documentaries. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. I'm going to do all this crazy stuff. And yes, it was all a sidetrack from, okay, what are you really going to do? And that's come to terms with retiring from soccer, because I didn't want to deal with that. That's real stuff. I want to go and have a party and bounce around the world. So I went out to the desert. And when I was out there, I felt alive for the first time in several years. And it was because I wake up every day with a purpose. I was around like-minded people who were all a little bit nutty, to be honest. And I was out there by myself, grinding away, so learning about myself. And it's like, I love this stuff. I love pushing myself to my limits. And I love seeing the world. I love seeing new things. And when I got back, I thought, if people are going to take me serious as an adventurer, as an endurance adventurer, as I called myself, because there's not too many of those around, because I made the title up, I just thought, I need to do something big. I need to do something massive. No one's ever done to put me on the map. And at this stage, I'd only been a ultra runner, an endurance runner for like 6 months. And I didn't own a bike. I'd never done any cycling I grew up, as I said earlier off air, next to a dairy farm. I didn't grow up next to the beach, you know, so I was in the country. So I didn't swim much. And then I was just like, right, let's stare at the world map with nothing but adventure on my mind and see what pops out to me. And it's literally what I did. And the route of the ultimate triathlon, which is from Morocco to Monaco, popped out at me. So the Strait of Gibraltar between Morocco and Spain just was like, initially I was like, well, there's a little bit of water. Maybe I could swim that. And I was like, okay, let's pull on this thread a little bit. Okay, now let's follow the coast because that makes more sense. To me anyway. So I was like, maybe I could cycle that. You know, swim, cycle. And I went my finger, as I'm doing now, up the coast. And went, oh, there's France. Oh, maybe I could run. What country's next? And I went along the coast and there was Monaco. And the run route was a little bit short. It was a lot shorter than the cycle route, but the swim was a lot shorter than that. And I thought, maybe I could do that as a triathlon. And I went, right, Morocco to Monaco, that's what I'm going to do. And this was like, I think it was the end of 2011 or the start of 2012. I can't remember exactly when it was, but that was it. So I've spent the last 4 years before I did it last year, planning, organizing, like checking out if it's available to do, like, can I swim the Gibraltar Strait? I could. Have people cycle along that coast of Spain? They have. No one's ever done anything like this before, not even in the format of the 2,000 kilometers. And yeah, so I just set out that this was it. This is what I'm going to do. And 2013, 2014 was all about doing adventures, creating content for Luke Tversky, the endurance adventurer. And then last year in October, I went out and did it.
Phenomenal. First and foremost. And look, you know, the title of this podcast is Life Without Limits. And we're exploring the idea of what makes us human. And I want to tap back into that day when you're talking to your girlfriend or your friends and they're saying, maybe your body's not made up for it. Like, what? Because we all have that as athletes, of that moment where, like, we're faced with, oh my God, the thing I thought I'd do the rest of my life might not occur. But then you clicked into this other avenue of what makes you human. Curious what consciously was happening to you then.
Consciously, I didn't want to give up the dream at 25. Right. I didn't want to give up the dream at 26. I still had confidence in myself that when I was fit, that I could get a deal, I could get a contract. And I was willing to make all the sacrifices and get up early, go to rehab, do my rehab and things like this. I was still willing to do that 100%. And that's something that my parents installed in myself and my sister, my only sibling, that if you want something, you have to do everything in your power to give yourself the best possible opportunity to succeed. None of this stuff, if you work hard, it'll come to you. That's rubbish. If you work hard and do everything possible in your power, you give yourself the best possible opportunity to succeed. And that was something that my parents said to me. And I was still willing to do everything I possibly could to succeed in soccer. And that's why everyone was saying to me, maybe your body's this and that. And I'm like, well, I'm going to be retired a long time if I finish at 27. And the other kicker was, I didn't want to live with any regrets. Because I was hoping I was going to be alive for a long time, and I didn't want to have to carry this burden of what if I gave it another shot? What if I did the recovery? What if I did the rehab? What if I got strong? What if I went to a club and they needed a defender, which was my position, and I played out of my mind for the first couple of weeks and they gave me a 2-year deal? What if? I didn't want to live with that.
Where do you think that comes from for you?
The never giving up?
Yeah.
I've been thinking about this a lot lately because I've done, you know, a lot of interviews coming up over the ultimate triathlon and this and that. And it was last week, and I was in London and I was coming home from a screening I did over there for the ultimate triathlon documentary. And I remember the conversation I had with someone who's helped me write a book about it. And we were talking about something that I wrote in there and something that was on my parents' sort of next to the fridge, like in the kitchen where we saw every day. And it was a stork, a bird. And inside the mouth was this frog. You couldn't see the frog. All you could see was its arms coming out of the stork's mouth and gripping the stork's neck. And the catchphrase at the top was never give up. And that's sort of our family motto, because it's just never give up. So when you see something like that as long as I can remember when I was like 4 or 5 starting school, and it was there until I left home when I was 16. And, you know, there was times when I struggled with my football career and Mum would say, just remember the frog, you know, and it was, and I wrote about it in the book that I've been writing for the last 12 months and I just never clicked. And I realized that that's where it stemmed from. And I've just carried that on in my own way throughout the life. So when I think about giving up, occasionally it popped into my head, like, just think of the frog.
I have so many questions for you. Curious, I mean, you created the ultimate triathlon. I mean, like, there's people that do ultra triathlons and ultra marathons, but you were like, I'm going to actually be a map maker and I'm going to make my own map. When you presented that to your mom or whomever, what's the response like that?
I'm laughing now. Because that was the response. People just laughed. You know, people just laughed at me. And it's like, what are you doing with your life? Like, seriously. And it was a thing that, I can't remember, you had a guest on recently talking about just, even if, I think it was Ariel, even if you're not an actor, say you're an actor.
Right.
And that was it. I told everyone I was an endurance adventurer. And I hadn't even done an adventure yet, but that was it because I believed it. And I think it was a case of, I told everyone I'm doing the ultimate triathlon because I'm an endurance adventurer. And they're like, what are you doing? Like, you got to grow up. You got to get a real job. And I had this vision and no one else saw it at the time. So to get the route and to get the distance and how many days I was going to do it in, because it's never been done before. I didn't know how many kilometers in a day you could cycle. I didn't know if you could swim the straight. I didn't know how many kilometers in a day you could run. I'd never done any of that. So I asked one of my buddies who was a really good triathlete, did Ironman, qualified for the world championships, did Kona, all this stuff, really good athlete. So, and I've known him ever since we were about 10. And I'm like, called him up one day. I said, Barnsey, very stereotypical Aussie last name. Yeah, Barnes, so everyone calls him Barnsey. It's like, Barnsey, I've got this adventure coming up. He's like, oh yeah, what is it? And I said, it's going from Morocco to Monaco. And he's like, oh, yeah. He said, how far is the distance? And I said, oh, it's about a 10-mile swim, and it's about 800 miles on the bike, and then it's basically 14 marathons to finish it off. And he's like, yeah, well, that sounds stupid, but okay, go on. I said, 12 days. What do you reckon? And he's like, you're an idiot. I said, I need to go and look at this. And he'd come back. And he's like, 15 days, I reckon, max. He said, when are you going to do it? I said, 4 years' time. He goes, okay, there's plenty of time. And he'd come back, no, 14 days max. And I said, right, I'm doing it in 12. And that was it.
Wow. What was it like where you grew up?
It was an amazing place to grow up.
What was the name of the town?
Bathurst. Give a shout out
where
to
is Bathurst. That?
It's about 3.5 hours northwest of Sydney.
Okay.
Yeah, and small country town. When I grew up there, it was about 20,000 people, very family orientated, very working class. We had a university there that was big in sort of like media. A lot of people from around the state would come there for media and teaching and nursing, and a lot of sport, massive amounts of sports. There's been Olympians, there's been, you know, world champions, there's been a lot of professional athletes come out of town in numerous different sports. And as a kid, you basically sort of did one or two things. You played sport, and it not mean like looking to be a professional, but just most kids growing up in Bathurst played sport, or they went down on the other side of the tracks, you know, so to speak, with just got up to mischief like most kids would. But so I grew up in a very sporty family. My mum was an amazing basketball player and had an opportunity to train with the national team, but decided to have kids instead, which I'm very thankful for. My dad played rugby league till 40, and my mum gave him an ultimatum, which was very serious, that you retire at 40 or we get a divorce.
Okay.
So I'm very pleased he retired at 40. And my sister was the star athlete of the family. She was very good at field hockey. Very good at basketball, very good at athletics. And here I am, 2 years younger than her, knock-kneed, a little bit chubby as a kid, never got picked for any of the representative teams. And it was cool to grow up because all my friends, we would like just ride bikes, like, you know, 2-3 miles to each other's house. And we were known that we had to get home by dark or get our butt slapped, you know, something like that, or clip over the ears. And back in the day when no one cared about that. But yeah, it was really cool to grow up because we had a lot of friends and, you know, sport during the week. Summer would always be at training, and the weekends was sport. Summer, winter, didn't matter.
Did you feel as though you were a little different as a kid? Like maybe your lens that you saw life through was a little off kilter than the traditional sport athlete that you were around?
Probably, yes, but not until I was about 15, 16. So all I ever wanted to do was play professional soccer. And like as most little kids, my uncle was my hero because he played. And to be honest, he's just kicked the hell out of everyone. And I thought, that's cool. And so I got into playing that. My dad played rugby league. And every year he said, do you want to play rugby league this year? And I said, no, Dad, I want to play soccer. And he said, okay, that's cool. But every year he would ask and I would say no, and that was fine. So there was no pressure. He would have loved me to play that game, but I didn't fancy it. So I tried out for all these representative teams and never got picked. And it was brutal back then. You know, there's 25 kids, train all day. They sit down in front of the coach. The coach says, if I read your name out, come and sit behind me. And he reads out 20 kids' names. All 20 kids go behind him and sit there, and they're all clapping, high five. There's five kids in front of him, which is, I was always one of them. Better luck next year, guys. I'll see you later. And they would go away and talk and have the team talk. And, you know, all I ever wanted to do was basically get the tracksuit. I wanted the tracksuit, the representative tracksuit, and play with my mates. And I just was, and literally, I was not good enough. But I always go and ask the coach, what can I do better? And he's like, oh, Luke, I didn't call your name. Yeah, I know, but what can I do better? He's like, well, you can work on this, you can work on that. Okay, coach. And I'd go home and mum would say, oh, how'd you go? And I went, oh, no, I didn't make it, mum. She goes, oh, okay, then, well, what did the coach say? Oh, I've got to work on this. Okay, then, you know, maybe you can work on that for the next year. Okay. And it wasn't until I was about 15, I think I grew into my body and a little bit. So it was stopped being knock-kneed and I lost a bit of that puppy fat, so to speak. And I was working really hard for like 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. And I think a combination of that hard work where I would come home from school and try and do my homework really quick, which obviously probably wasn't the best idea for my marks at school. But then I'd get out in the backyard because mum let me kick the ball against the fence for an hour. And I did that for like 4 or 5 years. And I think the combination of growing into my body, all this hard work at 15, I got picked for this one team, and then it was going from not even really getting picked for the local team to having national coaches look at me in a year and a half time. And to answer your question in a long-winded way, it wasn't until then when I realized my lens was different to all the other 15-year-old kids. And the best sort of example I can give is we're laying down after a training session at this state camp. You know, and on our backs, eyes closed, dark room, here's this woman who we have no idea who she is, telling us to close our eyes, breathe deeply. Yeah, mindfulness training at 15. You know, that was, I'm 33 now, so it was a while back. And we're doing this. And you can imagine what it's like, 15-year-old kids, they're kicking each other, they're slapping each other in the face because our eyes are closed. And I'm into it. Mm. I'm like pushing people away. I'm like, leave me alone. Like, don't touch me. I'm getting into this. And then after that, I was like, my friends didn't want to do any extra training after school or before school. My dad would drop me to the gym and I'd do sort of like some body weight exercises and plyometric sprint training, swim training, anything to get fitter when I was like 15, 16. And I realized then I don't look at playing soccer the same as my friends. They look at it as they get away with natural ability. And because I get picked every year. And I looked at it as, I felt really lucky and I felt like that this was a start for me. So I really tried to push hard with all my extra training and none of my mates did.
I ask you that because I'm curious. We all have a path, right? And you just did this amazing film. We're going to get into the film in a minute here. Then you could all check it out at your website. We'll have all the links in the blog. But you have this upbringing that's around sport, but you clearly had parents that saw the world a little differently. And what I'm hearing is you had parents that clearly were ridiculously competitive as athletes, but also had an empathy to them and a value of relationship. And I wonder when, in your eyes, you transitioned from crazy competitor to, okay, see the world a little differently, to now I want to give back. Because you started this podcast off with this great conversation about this idea of you want to leave these trails of inspiration. I feel like you've been doing that probably your whole life, but I wonder when you became at least aware of it. Because at 15, you're leaving a trail of inspiration to the other kid that's like, oh, this is kind of cool. Oh, he told them to shut up? All right, I'm going to do that too. When did it become at least a thought that you were like, wow, yeah, this is kind of what I'm about, even if you didn't say it out loud yet?
Oh, that's a good question. I think there was times where I came in and out of it. And to be honest, when I started being picked as a captain for numerous teams, when I was a lot younger than the rest of the guys, I think I was 16, and I got picked to be captain for an under 18 team. And that didn't go down well for guys who played in the team for like 2 or 3 years. And here I am, some 16-year-old kid, and there I'm supposed to be a captain. Not tell them what to do, but be a captain. And I was always looked at it as I was just sort of like the guy who would sort of pull in the sheep that's going the wrong direction. But everyone else, if they're going in the right direction, I'd leave them alone, you know. And that's the way that I was a captain. So I sort of feel like I felt that that's when I wanted to give back, and that's when I wanted to inspire, and that's when I wanted to help people on their path. But more so with what I'm doing now, I think it was when I came back from the desert and I realized that what I did, 6 months training, never done a race before, and I'm chatting out there with some of these elite runners, and like they're inspired by my story. And they're like, wow, that's amazing. You shouldn't be here. You know, after 3 days, I was still in the top 50 out of 900 people. And I was like, I'm just running through the desert, you know? And they're like, well, how are you still here? Like, how are you still in the top 50? This is ridiculous. And these are guys, some of them are pros, some of them are sort of elite age groupers, so to speak. And I realized I was inspiring people with my story that, you know, I broke down with all these injuries. And I said, yeah, I've got scars of surgery here. So it wasn't just like making it up. And they're like, what? So I think the inspiration, like firsthand, was in the desert when these elite runners were saying, wow, that's amazing. And then I came back and I thought, I've got an opportunity here. I could either just go, oh, well, I'm just going to keep doing my own thing, or I could use this, you know, to help others. And that's something that I've, you know, always brought up with. My mm-hmm. parents always, you know, said that. And I thought, yeah, I'm looking to be this endurance adventurer. I still didn't really know what that meant, where that was going, but I thought I want to try and help others to sort of see their true potential and show them, with me doing all these crazy big challenges, which is not my message, it's my vehicle. I don't tell everyone you should go and do these crazy challenges. It's just okay. that's what grabs people, and that's what grabs people to my story. And then once they're in, it's like it doesn't bother me if you don't go and run marathons, but okay, let's try and see how we can get you start living life more, dreaming big and getting out of your comfort zone. And that's what I'm all about.
Perfect. I love that you're on this podcast. Like, the world sometimes just kind of happens. We didn't have this planned interview. It just kind of happened. And you literally live like the title. Like, you clearly don't have any limits in your life. Making a film is a very intimate experience, you know, and I've been lucky to be a part of that process. And It's special, right? And you're with your editor and you're seeing it and you're molding it. And I'm curious what your role was in terms of the frame by frame. And obviously you had to set this thing up. But before we go there, we're going to go in a little reverse order. I want to know what it was like the first time you saw yourself on a big screen with other people in a room.
Like in a proper cinema screen?
In a real cinema. You just had a screening in Pasadena. It's premiering in London, Australia, etc. But the first time, because I think that's a memory that those of us that are characters in a documentary, I mean, I remember my first one like yesterday, and I'm curious what it was when all of a sudden you're like, whoa, that's my face on that big screen up there.
I got a big bald head to start with, so being on a big screen, it like takes up a lot of the space. It was the world premiere in London. It must have been 3 weeks ago now. Really beautiful cinema and massive, probably big screen. And we sat down the guy did the voiceovers, one of my mates, Jason Bradbury, he did a bit of an intro, and I come down the front, had a bit of a chat, and I'd not seen any of the sort of the testing of on the cinema and stuff like this. Didn't need to be there for it. And sat down and it starts up and whatever. And the film, when your listeners go and watch it, it starts off with a bit of my background and stuff. It's not actually the little snippets of me. But then when I'm in full force on the screen, and I remember, I know exactly what you mean the first time you see yourself. And I was like, that's pretty cool. I like that. But it was like, man, my head's pretty big on that screen. Right.
I think there's something about, let me know if you disagree or not, but as a performer, as a competitor, as an athlete, we love big stages, right? We want the ball. You want the penalty kick. I wanted the basketball or the football and fourth down, game on the line. So to me, when I can remember seeing that when Life in a Walk premiered, and I was just like, I just kind of smiled. I was like, this is cool.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, it's a humbling moment, all those things. But I think as athletes, like you, like I would assume you expect your film to do really well.
Of course.
Just because that's your mindset. Not because you want to make millions or anything else, but just because as a competitor, that's just your standard.
Yeah, exactly. I've always been, well, once I started making those teams, there was a coach that picked me for a team when I was 15. And it was like getting picked for that team and having this one coach who was very well respected. He'd played for the Scottish national team and he was living in Australia and he picked me for this team. And I said, do you think I can make the regional team? And he's like, don't worry about the regional team. You keep working hard like you are, you'll make the state team. And I remember that moment. I was putting some balls in the back of his trunk and I was standing on the side of this road where we were training in this park. And it was like I'd been injected with this, some people say overconfidence, but I felt this injection of like confidence. I was like, right, that's it. I can do anything. Mm-hmm. And where my confidence these days and when I played football was like, yeah, give me the ball. I want to take that penalty kick and all that stuff. It came from then. So yeah, I have like my film should do amazing because it's got nothing to do with me. It's got nothing to do with money. It's just because I know how much work I've put into it.
Right.
And I know the story behind it. And you've seen it. The story is phenomenal. And it's not just about 2,000 kilometers in 12 days. It's not about triathlon. It's so much more to that. And I just think it's an amazing story. And I've had 7 screenings in the UK and in LA now. And everyone's just like, I can see when they come up and talk to me after the screening, we do a Q&A. It's a bit like they're not really sure what to say because they're in shock. And they're like, wow, like, I didn't see that coming. That's amazing. And how did you do this? And that's unbelievable. That's fantastic. I loved it so much. Thanks very much. And it's just really humbling because that's what I'm all about. I want people to start thinking, dreaming bigger and seeing the world, not with limits, but as an opportunity to grow themselves.
Right.
And so, yeah, I have no doubt that it should do well.
That's going to crush it, man. Okay, so for the filmmaker listeners that are listening to this podcast, yeah. Okay, 2011, you do your race, you're ready to roll, life transition. Then you said you were just creating, gathering content the next couple of years. When are you like, all right, not only am I going to do the ultra triathlon, but I'm going to the ultra triathlon documentary, but I'm going to crew up for this thing. Like, how does that process even begin? And how big was the crew? How did they make it happen? Because I'm watching it and part of me is like crying. Part of me is laughing. And part of me is like, how did that work? Like, where's that camera shot come from? Like, where's the audio? Like, mm-hmm. So take us from jump of inception of when you have that meeting, wherever it is. And you're mm-hmm. like, not only am I going to go run, swim and bike this, but we're going to film it.
Mm-hmm. I got a massive smile on my face because I'm going to flip this around. Okay. I want to ask you, you've made a film. You've been involved with broadcasting television for a long time. You know what it takes to make something like this, right? So what do you think it took to make something like this? How many crew, this and that? Give me your opinion from seeing the film, what you thought of the crew who filmed this and made it.
My first guess was one, in terms of one camera person with you, but I'm going to go with two because there was one scene where I was like, they had to have two cameras there. So I think two camera operators were with you and they probably did audio as well. I'm assuming everybody kind of had to be in that van that you were cruising in. And when you came back, I bet you had two editors, unless your cinematographers could edit. So I'd say like four people max. That's my guess.
One guy did everything.
Get out of here.
Yep.
And who was he? We'll give him a shout out.
So I'll give him a shout out in a second, but he did everything and he does his part time. It's not even his full time job filming and editing and stuff like this. He does little promos. And this is his first feature film that he's ever edited, he's ever been involved in. So Jay Cox from Physique Media, he is a magician with the camera and a magician with editing. And there's another story how he came about. So it was one guy filming. He had two cameras, like a proper big one. I couldn't tell you what it was. It was a big camera.
It was a nice one, yeah.
Yeah. And then he had one of those DSLR camera things. So he had big camera. He had one of those with the microphone on and all this stuff. And he had a couple of tripods. And we had like three or four GoPros that was just floating around the van on my bike and this and that. And the crew sort of would hold a GoPro occasionally and whatever. But it was all Jay. So if we were pulled over to the roadside and I was coming in to get to some food or whatever, like I've seen it because I've seen a lot more footage that's not in the film. Like he'll have one camera set up on a tripod and he'll be running around. And the crew would tell me, they'll pull over on the side of the road. And then all of a sudden Jay's like, I'll be back soon. And he just runs up this hill because he sees a shot.
Right.
And it might even be not with me, but he'll just get a shot of the crew. And then he will like, oh, there, I can see Luke coming up the hill now. So he runs somewhere else and gets that. And then I took off and then the guys are in the car and Jay's in the car. It's like, go, 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 go. We're ready to go. And it was just him doing all this. And as I said, like he does his part time. He does like promo stuff for businesses and companies and stuff like that. He does a little bit of mountain bike stuff with a semi-pro mountain bike team down where he lives in the south of England. But this is, yeah, it's just his hobby. Like he gets paid bits and pieces when he does stuff, but he just wanted a big project to sink his teeth into. And, we found each other.
I think he did sink his teeth into a pretty big project.
So to answer the second part of it was when we did sit down and have this meeting 3 weeks before I left with him. So there's a little bit more to it than that. But I had this vision that I'm going to make this documentary. And 2011 went by, 2012 went by, 2013 went by, and I was sort of sussing out things. And like I had no budget for this. Right. Like, that's the thing, like, people ask me, how did you fund this? Like, where'd you get this money, get sponsors? Do you have, like, a trust fund or anything like that? I'm like, no.
Right.
I've got a couple of sponsors who chucked in a few bits and pieces. I put a hat around just all family and friends and said, $5, $10, whatever you got. I did a crowdfunder, which I only raised about 40%. Of what I aimed for, and what I aimed for was about 60% of my entire budget. So, you know, that helped, right. But it wasn't it. I had a private sponsor come in at the last minute that basically ticked us over because I was all out of money at day 9. I didn't know how to feed the crew or put petrol in the car for the last 3 days. And that came in late. And basically, whatever money I had and whatever money the bank would lend me, I took it. And put it all into this because this is a big investment for me because my business, you know, this was a big thing. So then 2014, a filmmaker got in touch with me because I've been advertising. I'm making a film about it and I'm trying to find someone who would come and do this and whatever. And everyone's just so expensive. And I had no idea what it cost for a filmmaker or a film crew or nothing. I was like, oh, yeah, just hold a camera and this and that. So naive, just like everything else. Yeah, I'm going to do Desert Race with 6 months of training.
Right.
And yeah, that's what dreaming big's all about and not being afraid to fail. So I had this idea that I'm going to make this film. It's going to be great. It's going to inspire people. It's going to be amazing. It's going to be crazy. And then this filmmaker got in touch with me. He's like, I've seen you doing this. Yeah, let's meet up. So we met up and had a coffee. He goes, well, come down to the lake near where I live and we'll do some swimming. We'll do some filming. We'll do some cycling. And we'll suss each other out and you can see what I do. Cool. So we sat down, he's like, yeah, what do you think? I said, yeah, it looks all good, all right. And I said, I just thought I'd throw it out there. I said, I've got one question though. Would you be happy to just be paid after the film's been made and edited from when it gets downloaded? And he's like, what do you mean? And I said, because I can't pay you. I said, what do you think? And he says, we'll just go, you know, we'll split the downloads like when we sell the film at the back end. He says, I'll pay for all your expenses. The Ultimate Triathlon will pay for your expenses and that. So, yeah, this is low, low budget.
Right.
And he's like, yeah, cool. No worries. Let's do that. Cool. This all is right. Jay. So, no. This is another guy. This is another. I only met Jay 3 weeks before, remember? So, this is another guy. So, I was, oh, yeah, cool. So, he signed up. We did some promo stuff. It was good. It was pretty good. And about 5 weeks before we was planning to go out. No, about 6 weeks before we planned to go out. He goes, Luke, I'm really sorry. I can't come. I've got this project that's ongoing for the next 3 years. And it's basically for 6 weeks out of every year at the same time because it's a race. So I've got to go and do it. I've got to take it. It's really good money. And I'm like, yeah, yeah, no worries. Cool. Hung the phone up and I was just like, I've pitched this to sponsors. I've pitched this to everyone that I'm making a documentary with this filmmaker. I've got all this promo stuff and they've seen the quality of it. And, you know, like you and I came together and the universe works in wonderful and mysterious ways. It was about a week or two after that, I get this message online from this guy. And he's like, love your story. I heard you on the Rich Roll podcast. I was on his podcast last year and it's this amazing story. It's fantastic. I know you've got a filmmaker, but I'm a part-time guy. I do little promos. I'd love to get involved. I'd love to do some promos for you. Can I, like, you know, edit some of the footage that you got? I'd love to help out however I can. And I'm like, how would you like coming out and filming it, being the filmmaker? And he's like, what do you mean? I said, long story, filmmaker just pulled out last week. Do you want to come? And he's like, yeah, I'm in. And I'm like, okay, are you married? He's like, yeah. Have you got kids? Yeah, I've got two kids. Right. Go away. Talk to your wife and your kids. I didn't want to be the guy who like split up this marriage and family. So I said, go away and talk to them and talk about it. It's going to be basically 3 weeks. And I told him the deal. Can't pay you. You know, I'm going out on a whim here with him. And I said, but we'll deal with this after and I'll pay for all your expenses and that, whatever. And he's like, okay, cool. And he called me back. Because I was really, really hectic and flat out this time. I'm still trying to get funding. I'm training 25 to 30 hours a week. I'm doing other motivational speaking, training other clients, all the stuff that I do. And I said, look, the only time I can talk, Jay, is when I'm out on a training run. He said, okay, cool. So I'm out on like a 4-hour training run. He calls me and I said, Jay, how you doing? Yeah, good. I asked Katie, his wife, I can come. I can come. He's like a little kid at Christmas. He's like, I can come. Okay, no worries. And he said, yeah, cool. That's it. No worries. And that was it. He's like, okay, all I need is this, this, and this, little bits and pieces. I'll go and sort the rest out. I said, okay, cool. And he went out and he bargained. He hired this camera that was supposed to be like 150 pounds a day or something like that, or 300 pounds a day, something ridiculous. You come back, I got it for 150. I'm like, I can't afford 150 pounds a day. He goes, no, for the whole trip. Like I just bargained with him. I told him you'll put it through tweets out. And we're making this documentary. And we'll mention you in the credits and stuff. And they bought it. And I was like, sweet. So we got this. Yeah, a camera that should have cost us thousands of pounds for like 150 pounds for the whole time. Wow. And it was all these things kept falling into place. And at the time, I was just like, oh, well, that's cool. But I sort of feel like I'd done so much work and I went all in and I put so much, you know, faith and everything else, whatever you want to call it, into this project. And it was almost like at the last moment, 3 weeks before I was going out, Jay come around. It's like, I'll do it. And then I thought, well, I've got to meet this guy. I've got to see if he can actually film and edit stuff. So I said, I was doing this massive big training block. And part of it was cycling 200 kilometers a day, every day for 3 days with some ocean swims. So I said, I'll cycle down to you. He lived 200 Ks away from me, down on the coast. And my girlfriend was going to catch the bus down. And we'll meet you there, whatever. And I'll go for a swim. And then we'll do some filming afterwards. Okay. So I cycled down there. He found me, had a tracker on me, so he found me, filmed me while I was cycling, got down there, had a bit of a chat for 10 minutes, so I've got to get in the ocean here, and I did like a 2-mile swim, and him and my girlfriend walked up and down the beach. I got out, we did some filming, and then he went home, and I said to my girlfriend, Vander, I said, so what's he like? Oh, he's amazing, you got to take him, he's awesome, he's a nice guy, he's just really cool, he's like, oh, hang on, can we stop here, I want to get this shot and whatever, and I was like, sweet, he's hired. The next time I saw him was in Spain before we did it.
Wow.
So one guy, Jay Cox, Physique Media, he's amazing and he edited it all. Took him like 9 months. He's got a full-time job. He did this on the weekends and the nights. And his wife, Katie, you know, we're all one big family now and she's been so supportive. She's been amazing. And it was awesome to sit in the cinema that very first day, a few Sundays ago in London, to watch the film and he was there. And we're all so proud of him and it swings both ways. And yeah, this would not have happened without him. And yeah, I'm just so grateful that he listens to the Rich Roll podcast and I was on it at that one time and we got connected.
There is a beauty to putting a crew together. You know, I felt, I'm curious about you. Like, I would assume, yes, everybody, I saw the characters in your film, and it seemed as though there was like the trainer, nutritionist, right? There's like your buddy, who I love, by the way.
Warren.
Yeah, Warren.
He's a star of the show.
He's hilarious. Obviously, yourself. There's a couple ancillary characters that kind of come in and out throughout. But you're right. It becomes this, to me at least, it fills a void of the team. You know, we grew up as jocks. We wanted a team so bad. And then you got to be a captain of one. And you all got to kind of handpick your crew and your squad. So I'm curious about, as we dive into the film, and the links will be on the blog post, but there's some really vulnerable moments. Like, there's some moments in that film that you're in pain. Like, and anybody who's an athlete, like, has trained really hard. And if you've ran a marathon, you get what the last mile is like. But none of us have done what you've done to your body. And I'm curious in the moments where, I mean, you weren't on the proverbial breaking point. Like, you were breaking. Your body was borderline broken. And I'm curious, with that team around you, did you ever think twice about, like, I can't show weakness. I can't do this. Because you just seemed so raw the whole film.
It was never about not showing weakness because, okay, apart from Jay, who I'd met for 5 minutes before we were in Spain, Warren and Erica, they're a couple, and I'd known them for couple of years, and they were very close with me, and I'd done some work with the nutrition company that that they sponsor me as well, and 33 Shake, all real food, you know, that's how I eat, so I knew I was getting some good wholesome food there, and I've worked with them for several years, both as an athlete for their company, but also just as friends. And Vanda, my girlfriend, who was my medical officer, we were only dating for about 6 months, so
she got to see you raw.
So it was, we're talking about this last night with someone at the screening, and like, I gave her a get out of jail card before we, because she said, oh, I'll come if you like and be your medical officer. She's got a medical background, and I'm like, you can, but if you don't want to, I understand, and it's cool because things are going to get pretty crazy. And she was like, no, it's fine. And I knew I'd either have a partner for life when right. I came back, or I'd be single. It was literally, it was going to be that. So she was all in, you know. She was, she's done an Ironman. She swam the channel before. So she knows endurance sports. And also Warren and Erica, the other two crew, they've done ultra endurance cycling. They've done Ironmans and ultra marathons and stuff. So they know endurance. And I knew this. And we had informal chats. Like, there was no crew meetings, like, right, here's the itinerary.
Right.
We would chat over dinner, and I would call Wazza and say, oh yeah, you know, and I said to them, I said, look, I'm gonna finish this no matter what. And I said, I've been working on this so hard for many years, and I said, it's gonna happen no matter what. And they know I'm quite stubborn, but also they know how driven I am. And there's a difference between stubborn and driven, I think. And they knew how much work I'd put into this. So they were there to just sort of help me along. And it was always, let's just do whatever Luke's doing. Even though I was like passed out cycling on day 4 or whatever it was and not having any idea, I was just forging through. And, you know, even then, like, with, not to give any spoilers away, but even then, like, Vander and Warren had a conversation when I was unconscious in the back of the van. Should we call it a day when he's like 10 miles from the end, or should we wake him up and see if he wants to get back on the bike?
Right.
Like, I look at that and I look at it as a logical person going, that's ridiculous. He's unconscious. You're not going to put him on the back of the bike. But they knew how much it meant to me. And yeah, that was a time where they had to go, no, that's enough. But the other times when I was in physical pain, and you can see it when I had muscle tears, and, you know, when I started to lose like semi-consciousness and I'm walking, thinking I'm running and my head's bobbing because I've lost control, and I don't remember any of that. I've seen the film 12 times now. I don't remember still after seeing it. And they were there to support me and get me to the end. And it was not about showing weakness, because I'm happy to be vulnerable and show weakness. There's a lot of that in the film. And I'm about showing it real, showing it as is. So they were just there to get me from A to B. And they weren't going to stand in the way. They weren't going to pull me unless it was a life or death type thing. And I remember the conversation I had with Jay, because he's a cameraman. And we talked about scenarios of what if, and what if this happens, what if that happens. And when we're in Tarifa, the south of Spain, before we started, we're out there for like 3-4 days. I said to him, I said, Jay, if I get hit on the bike and I get smashed up on the guardrail and, you know, bike spangle or whatever, get 5 seconds of footage and then throw the camera and then come and deal with me. And he laughed and I'm like, I'm serious. I said, if something happens and I stack it or I get hit or whatever, get those 3 or 5 seconds of footage and then come and help me. There's 3 other people who were there, but hold on to the camera, get that little clip and then go on, because I want to show people exactly what happened.
Mm.
You know, and that was the conversations that we had, like the real and raw ones. And that's what I was willing to do to make this film as real and, you know, not as fluffy as some of the documentaries like with endurance sports that I've seen. But yeah, and that was it.
Look, do you want kids someday?
Oh, my girlfriend's going to listen to this. You're killing me. I've actually been thinking about this lately. And I'm in the middle of processing it.
So let's just pretend you say yes.
Yeah.
And to your girlfriend. Pretend. Let's just pretend right now. Just say yes. He's not officially on the record.
She knows I'm talking to you at the moment, yeah. But I'm not going to tell her to listen to her. That's for sure.
But I would love you to be a parent, right? Let's just visualize here, right? And you're watching your child go through what you went through. What would you do? And I'm talking about the moments when you're literally, you'd think you're drunk, right? You'd think, I'm taking notes as I'm watching and I'm like, oh my God, like I'm worried you're going to not just fall, but get hit by a car. I'm worried that you're going to go off a cliff, like, and I don't even meet you yet. But be a parent and see a kid here, because I'm just curious.
My mum's not seen the film yet either, so that could be interesting. It depends why my child was doing it. If he was doing it for all the same reasons I was doing it, and if he'd done the preparation, and if he was in a similar mindset to me, then I would support it, because otherwise that's hypocritical, you know, with the way that I think and the way that I live my life. And I'm trying to be as much of a parent as possible. I think it's one of those things where I would be standing around supporting with bawling tears in my eyes, but going, okay, if this is what he wants, then I'm going to support him or her and this, that, whatever. But I think if it was a bit sort of, you know, like you've seen it with athletes, they think they want to do the work and they think they've done the preparation. When it comes to game day or a race or whatever, they're a little bit undercooked. And it's a bit like, yeah, you're going to get hurt. Now I'm going to pull you off here. If my child went into and did something like this and they were like that, and I knew they hadn't done the training, I knew they hadn't done physical or mental training, they hadn't done the preparation, they hadn't got scenarios A to Z times 10, you know, what could happen if this and that and different scenarios. If they had all that in place, yeah, I think I'd have to fight back a parenting instinct and just go, well, I'm here to support you because I know this is what you want and I know you've done the work. But if they hadn't done the work, then I may intervene or just drop a little pearl in their head and go, well, you remember that session you missed? Maybe this is why.
Yeah. Last couple, man. We'll let you get out of here. But why were you so committed to the timeline? Like, well, there was no race, right? There was nobody next to you. And your body, I mean, you were broken. And I don't want to hear how, like, what the recovery was just yet. I want to get there at the end here. But curious why you were so steadfast on the timeline. Like, I'm watching it, I'm saying, like, dude, give yourself a day, bro. Like, you rest one day and you might get 3 on the back end.
Initially it was stubbornness, because I came up with this idea. I thought, yeah, it's gonna be 12 days, and I asked my mate Barnsey and a few other people, and they're like, no, you can't do it in 12 days. And that's a red flag to a bull for me. You can't do it. You're not good enough. And you know, that's where a lot of this comes from as well, was I was never picked as a kid. So I was like, right, I'm going to go away and work my butt off. And I don't think it was to prove anyone wrong. It was just almost like, well, if you said I can't do it, I'm going to go and do it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it was just the fact that it sounded good. 2,000 kilometers in 12 days. 2,000 kilometers in 14 days.
Yeah, I hear you.
It's whatever. But initially it was because they sort of said, oh, you can't do it. And I was like, well, no, this is what I came up with initially. And I thought it sounded pretty good. And then I ran with it for a period of time. And I went, I'm just going to stick at it. You know, and because also, if I said I'm going to do this in 15 days and I rescheduled distances, the research I'd done with other endurance athletes and things like this, I thought people will go, oh, wow, that's pretty amazing. But endurance athletes would be going, well, you know, that's not that difficult if you're doing this type of stuff. Right. So I wanted to get eyebrows raised and I wanted to do something that no one had ever done, the distance, nothing like this before. And as I said, to create something big to put me as an endurance adventurer on the map.
Yeah, no, we did the same thing with the walk with my dad and I. It was like, okay, we were both broken, you know, our feet, our knees, whatever. And it was like, no, we're going to do 15 miles today. Like you just, I think it's just an athletic mindset where, and you have this great line in the movie where you're like, you just got to get me, you just got to get my feet on the ground because I just got to put one foot in front of the other. And it's kind of like, that's the process of an athletic high performance mind, I think, of, you just roll me out there because once I get going, look out.
Hmm. Yeah, I was just going to do everything I possibly could that day. And as you see in the film, I went till I dropped.
Literally. So take us through, all right. So the final day, I love the end of the movie. The credits are hilarious. But what don't we see? Like, what does your body go through? And just to paint a picture for those of you that haven't even seen the trailer yet or listening to this, you're going ridiculous distance, you're swimming, you're running, you're biking, you're running, like you have to run to finish this race off, or this proverbial race off. You're only racing against yourself for 12 days. I felt like you rarely slept, and your body had broken, your quad was basically torn, your hamstring was torn. I don't even know how much weight you lost, but you just look like a different human at the end of this film. What happens when you've crossed it? And is it a feeling that you wrote about in your blog about one of the first races you had? You felt empty. I'm curious what you felt like after this and the 12 days were over. Congratulations, everybody else. Jay goes back to his life and his wife and his two kids.
Well, I was on a good friend of yours, Michael Gervais' podcast last year, and he said, are you going to celebrate this one? Because, you know, we chewed through some things, and it was one thing I very rarely did. I didn't celebrate my achievements. It was like, I did it. It's done now. Okay, what's next? Moving on. And we talked about that. And I listened back to my podcast, not because I like to hear the sound of my own voice. Well, I do, but that's not the reason. It's I want to learn from the guy that's talking. So I want to learn from me, from my answers. And over time, I evolve. So I go back and listen to podcasts and interviews I've done several years ago. And I go, yeah, that's where I was then, but this is where I am now. So the 12 days that I did the Ultimate Triathlon was all about a celebration. I'd done the hard work. I'd, you know, busted my backside. So it was all about celebrating it. And I knew once I finished that my life was never going to be the same again, which I think I said that in the film. And it wasn't because there was going to be fanfare and there was going to be cameras and this and whatever, apart from Jay's, because there wasn't. There was a couple of us there on this roundabout and that was it. It was because I had created a dream, set it with clarity, busted my backside, had to adapt when I had setbacks. And this is over 5 years and also the 12 days. And then I was going to complete it. And I was going to do this thing. And the journey that I had over the 5 years from conception to finish and over the 12 days, it made me realize that it's okay to celebrate. It's okay to congratulate yourself because you've done the work and this is an amazing achievement. And not to give anything away, but you know, I kissed the rock. That's the entry to Monaco. And literally in my head, it was like, as soon as you turn around, your life is never going to be the same again. And when I turned around, I was just so happy that, one, I didn't have to swim, cycle, or run anymore. And they handed me my crutches, which is, you know, you'll understand when you see the film. But also that all the people said I couldn't do it, all the dramas I had with raising money to feed the crew and pay for petrol and this and that, filmmaker pulling out, finding Jay, him saying yes to, you know, not making any money from this whole 12-month project, and just having the crew there who gave up 2 weeks of their life, and all the support I had via social media during the 12 days and everyone who's helped me before, I felt like it was a team effort from everyone. And I just felt really pleased that the people who stuck by me that I felt like I get really emotional because I'm talking about it. It's still close to me. I'm proud of them just sticking by me. That makes sense. So I knew that things wouldn't be the same in terms of I achieved this massive goal, and they haven't been, because I see the world differently now, and my comfort zone, my bar has been raised that high that I don't feel like there are any limits, because I feel like it's, if you put limits on yourself, then you're putting the limits on. If someone's telling you you can't do that, someone else is suppressing you and putting the limits on. But if you just stop, take a step to the side and take that limiting cap off, there's no limits. It's all from external energy, external forces that are putting the limits on you, or internal ones for yourself. So if you stop that, or if you get out of the way of those external forces and go, well, there are no limits, because it's all been made up. It's all been jumped on top of me.
Where do you think, because you ran a race that didn't have a community. You know, for those of us that ran marathons, it's one of the coolest sporting events to be a part of, because you're with 25,000 other people. You know, whether you're playing college football in the U.S. or you're playing football over in the U.K. or in Oz, you got a crowd, you have teammates. You had your filmmaking crew and your team that you just referenced. But I'm curious, in a singular sport, you're alone a lot of the time, right? Mm-hmm. Where, when you look back on it, was your greatest growth? Internally, intrinsically, mm-hmm. mentally.
During the 12 days?
I think just fundamentally. Like, okay. Where have you evolved as a man? I mean, because clearly, if we rewind this podcast, you're a guy that's wanted to inspire your whole life. You're a guy that's taken chances. Okay, somebody says no, you say yes. You put a goal out, you chase it. Okay, those things are done. Like, you accomplished. Those are check, check, check. Where have you grown in areas that you weren't aware of?
I think I've had spurts throughout my life. It was definitely when, I mentioned earlier where I got picked for a big captain of an under-18s team. I'm with 18-year-old guys and I'm barely 16. And that was a time where I had to grow up, And I left home when I was 16. And that was the time I had to grow up. I was living by myself at 17. I had to grow up, and I remember the first time I was in this apartment by myself at 17, and my parents helped set it up, and they went 3 hours away, and I went, okay, now what to do? I had some dinner and watched some television, went to bed and cried all night, and I was just like, I got up the next morning and went, right, okay, this is life. This is my new normal, and this is it. Mm-hmm. So I had my little cry, had my night, and that was it. And I had a big, massive growth spurt there in terms of as a human. But I really feel the biggest one has been like this summer, just gone. It's been amazing to. It's almost like a few I's have been dotted and T's have been crossed, where everything I've been trying to achieve and the message I've been trying to get across and the message that I've believed that I've been trying to spread, but to be honest, didn't quite understand it fully, but just I wanted to do this. I wanted to inspire. I want people to get out of their comfort zone. I can now, I feel like that I understand it intrinsically more and I can articulate it better. And also now I've got examples of people to see it. So there's these three elements to it. And I really feel like this summer where I've, as a human, as a man, I've definitely grown, and it's been tough because I've not done any training this year. I've not done any challenges. They're creating screening opportunities and doing interviews and things for the Ultimate Triathlon and trying to talk to media to try and come along to screenings, all this type of stuff that everyone deals with. This is all new to me. So I was doing that, trying to promote it all, and this was my adventure. So physically, I've done nothing. And that was tough, but I realized it's okay. I don't have to just beat myself up.
Last one from me, man. A lot of people listening to this are people who maybe were told no a lot in their life, right? Goal-oriented, for instance, if you want to just use a general phrase, or just chasing and charging in life. And I'm curious that when I watched your film and saw you run and swim and bike and hurt and all of those and sleep and get... I mean, you see everything in this film, by the way, everybody. But it's a very... at times, I wonder if it's a lonely event, a lonely process. And I think a lot of people that are high performers, there's an element, there's always this bridge in our life where we go from, you know, we're driven, we're self-motivated, and there's a loneliness that we all deal with. Curious if you've made the transition or how you view the idea of sharing and love. Because not necessarily just with the love of the craft, but the idea of love. Because you're seeing it now, right? Your film is no longer just with you and Jay. You know, it is being spread across the globe, literally, as we speak. And I think a lot of listeners, you know, me specifically, I'm curious about that as well, of how do you view sharing and love now being in such an individual event and an individual sport?
Yeah, very different to how I used to. You know, I was very self-motivated and self-driven, and I was like, everything else doesn't matter. And, you know, that's cost me a few relationships in the past, like both just friends and also partners and things like this, because I've been quite had the blinkers on. But I've realized that to be able to achieve not just the ultimate triathlon, but to be able to achieve in life, that we do have to share. And just from this side of it, that if you want to achieve big things, that you can't do it alone. And the big thing that I've realized, and not realized, but a big thing I've learned about, was creating that tribe or that community, whatever you want to call it, around you, where you've got like-minded people and people who see your vision, people who see your dream. Like initially where I saw it in the desert, I woke up every day with a purpose, and I was around people who not were going, what are you doing this race in the desert for? This and that. They're there with me, like-minded people. That was my tribe. I knew no one out of the 850 people there, but that was it. So I guess I felt like I understood how to embrace my community, my tribe, and work together with that. And also, in terms of the love factor, is first and foremost, I've learned how to love myself a lot more, and I'm okay with that. And because I was always, like as I said, I'd do a challenge, that's done, move on. But I've realized to sort of like, well, no, hang on. If you're feeling a bit down, a bit flat, then that's okay. You know, you can show yourself a bit of compassion. And that's not weak. That's not anything. It's just what you should do to become whole. And that's one thing I've really learned to embrace. And it's not been easy, you know. But, I do feel alone a lot of the times training and doing challenges and this and that, whatever. But at the same time, I know now that I have this community around me of people, this tribe that I have, and they're always there with me, and I can give them a call and bounce ideas off and whatever. And there's a lot of love. But in a good place at the moment.
Yeah, no, it's awesome. Well, my favorite part of the film is you go to your journal and you read what you've written. And you said the quote was, "I had a dream crowded with clarity to push my limits so I could see a glimpse of my potential." Well, I got to tell you, man, like your potential just is, it's a gift that you're even in this room, in this place. This film is phenomenal. I love the vulnerability that you showed in it and clearly show in your life, man. Tremendous, really. Congratulations.
Thanks, buddy. Appreciate that.
Yeah. So how can people see the film?
So people can go to theultimatetriathlon.co and you can click on the trailer, and the trailer goes straight to Vimeo, and that's where you can download or buy the film. Or you can go to Vimeo and type in the Ultimate Triathlon documentary, and it's up there now worldwide. You could rent it, buy it. If you do watch it and you think it's not bad, write a comment. That really helps us all. And you can connect with me on social media. I'm on Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, Instagram. It's Luke Tobersky. My website is luketobersky.com or theultimatetriathlon.co, and you can find everything there. Give me a shout. I answer all my social media and everything. I'm a real person, and come say hi. And yeah, if you've got questions about the film or why, how, or anything else, just drop me a line. I'd love to connect with people.
I'd recommend everybody to not only watch the film, but then connect with you, invite you out, have a Q&A. It's a special piece, man. Thanks for allowing us to share it.
Thanks, Yogi. Thanks for having me.
You got it.
All right, there it is. Luke Tobersky. Are you kidding me? What a ridiculous conversation. What an awesome goal. I cannot wait to see what he does next. Now, speaking of what we're doing next, I'm on my way to Israel. It is going to be off the hook. Based on the documentary we did that you all supported, and thank you for that, What Does It Mean to Be Human? It kind of picked up a little steam. So I'm heading over to the Middle East.
It is going to be awesome. We're going to explore that community. They actually have American football there, and have so many unique conversations around food. I'm going to go surfing, going to do some acro yoga, some fire dancing. It's going to be a unique trip. And most importantly, like we always do on this, we want to chase our story and where we're from. I'm going to explore with no real guidelines the town that my mom grew up in. And if you all recall, she was the very first episode, very first interview on the Life Without Limits podcast. So I'm going to head up to Haifa with three pictures and a birth certificate and see what happens. So we'll have some fun content for you, some unique conversations. And as always, I appreciate the love and support. And like we want to always end these unique conversations, the simple tagline, the only limits that we have in life are the ones we set ourselves. Peace.